So the title of our lecture this week, Walking in Their Ordinances, is a translation of the Pasuk, B'chukoseim lo se lechu, Pashas Achrimo, as the Torah says, K'masei Eretz Kanan, Asher ani mevi eschem shama lo sasu, do not do the practices of Eretz Kanan, K'masei Eretz Mitzrayim, Asher yashavtem ba lo sasu. And the Torah summarizes this as, U'v'chukoseim lo se lechu, which I translated following actually the King James, B'chukoseim lo se lechu, that thou shalt not walk in their ordinances. The article I see here actually has, do not follow their traditions. Now, this is actually going to be a crucial thing, as we discussed, the translation of chukah itself is going to be an important point, as we'll see. This basic prohibition in the Torah against copying the ways of the non-Jews appears a number of times in the Torah. It also appears in Parshas Kedoshim. At the end of Parshas Kedoshim, the Torah says that you're going to go into Eretz Yisrael, you're going to inherit the land, and it says the non-Jews did terrible things, and Hashem says, follow my chukim, ushmartim es kol chukosag, etc., and the land will not spit you out. You shall not walk, again, in the word chukah, in the ordinances or traditions of the... Again, article has traditions, do not follow in the chukos of the goy, the nation, asher ani mishlach b'pnechem. Don't follow in their ways. They did all these terrible things, and I became revolted and repulsed by them, and I got rid of them. And so on. Hashem says, I have separated you. A very common idea throughout the Torah that you shall not follow in the terrible ways of the non-Jews. Now, the question, of course, is which ways are we referring to? They do lots of things. Some of them we certainly do. So what exactly is meant when the Torah says, do not follow in their ways? The basic problem, which has been the source of contention for thousands of years, going back to Talmudic times, among the Tanoim, and down to the present, arguments about Thanksgiving celebrations and so on, the basic problem is that the definition of their ways is very poorly defined and is full of inconsistencies and ambiguities, and all the literature on this topic, basically most of it revolves around the question of what are the ways in question that the Torah prohibits, and what are considered normal things that we're all human beings, and we all do some of the same things. This basic problem is highlighted by the Taras Kohanim. So, again, before we mention the Taras Kohanim, if you read the Psukim, in both cases, the Torah writes this prohibition of lo selchu b'chuk sagoyim, b'chuk seim lo selechu. The Torah specifically mentions the lands, the pagan nations, the cultures which the Jews would be experiencing or would be replacing the previous inhabitants in Eretz Canaan. It specifically mentions Mitzrayim and Canaan. And in both places, the Torah goes on and talks about some of the things they did. Right in Achrimos, where it says, B'chukoseim lo telechu, the Torah goes on to talk about Arayas, incest, basically, all the prohibited types of unions. And in Kedoshim, too, right after the Torah goes through, again, another list of incest and bestiality and stuff like that, the Torah says, in summary, don't go in their ways. You're holy. I've separated you. Go into the correct ways. So, a simple reading of the Psukim might lead one to think that the ways in question refer to ways that are otherwise prohibited, that are otherwise decreed, are abominations. And the basic question, again, the basic tension between what are the ways that are prohibited and what are the ways that are just normal human conduct is expressed by the Taras Kohanim. It says, B'chukoseim lo telechu, the Taras Kohanim says, you might think that means, Yachal lo yivnu binyanim, you can't do construction. We can't engage in agriculture. We can't plant trees. Kamosim, that's what they do. We can't do that. That's what you might think. That's obviously not correct. Talmalomar b'chukseim lo telechu. Lo amarti, and here's where the translation of chukim becomes important. Lo amarti ela b'chukim hakakukim lahem v'lavoseim v'lavosavoseim. A very unclear bit of language. It says, the chukim we mean are the chukim that are hakukim, that were promulgated as edicts, for them, v'lavoseim, v'lavosavoseim. Them, their fathers, and their grandfathers. That sounds a little bit like tradition, like Artgirl has it. Not exactly clear what are normal things and what are chukim achakukim lahem v'lavoseim. Mahayuosim, example, what does the Torah mean? So the Torah's Kohanim answers, again, basically sexual perversions. The Torah says, ha'ish nosi la'ish, male homosexuality, ha'isha la'isha, lesbianism, ha'ish nosi isha ubita, Arayas, Haisha Nisis Lishnayim, Polyandry, L'kach nemar b'chukaseim lo teleich. So the Medrash seems to say that the kind of things the Torah has in mind are anyway practices that the Torah mostly condemns as abominations. Lesbianism is less clear, but the other one certainly the Torah explicitly decrees as terrible. But again, from the Torah's column, we still don't know. Clearly, to build buildings and to plant trees is mutter. Clearly, to engage in sexual perversions is usher. And everything in between, which is most of the interesting cases we're going to talk about, are not clear. Are they like building buildings, or are they like engaging in arayas? So we just don't know. So, as I said, there's an enormous amount of literature. One other question we should mention before we get into some of the practical cases, one other question we should mention, again, and I've kind of led up to this, is that in the Psukim, the prohibition appears in the context of Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Canaan. In Achremos, it says Eretz Mitzrayim, Eretz Canaan. End of Parshas Kedoshim, it says, the nations that I'm expelling from you don't follow their ways, which seems to refer to the Canaanites. So there is some discussion in the Rishonim, the medieval authorities, about whether the copying the non-Jews refers specifically to the ancient pagan nations, the Zionamun, Eretz Canaan, Mitzrayim, whether it applies to all idolatrous nations, whether it applies to even non-idolatrous nations. So in the Rishonim you find some debate about this, but again, the consensus of the later poskim, the consensus seems to be that it applies to any non-Jewish culture, even Yishmaelim, some poskim say, even if they're not Ovdei Avodah Zarah. In general, just from the preponderance of halakhic literature on these topics, generally it is assumed that any practice that you find associated with non-Jews, rarely do the poskim stop and say, well, they're not pagans, they're not Canaanites, they're not Amorites, they're not Egyptians. Rarely does that seem to be a major factor, so the kind of unspoken consensus seems to be that these are just examples. But the prohibition is not limited to Canaanites, Egyptians, and Amorites. But again, the question is, that really links to the other question, which is, what kind of practices are we referring to? Does it have to relate to paganism and idol worship? Is it Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, great German posik from a century and a half ago, he has a discussion, we'll get to it a little bit later in more detail. He's discussing playing the organ in synagogues, which he was vehemently opposed to, and he argues that it's kukus hagayim, and when he wants to argue for a broader interpretation of the prohibition of kukus hagayim, he uses German words, I forget what they exactly are, but he says it doesn't mean basically gesetzschaft, worshipping of idols, it means Fremder cultus, foreign culture, or non-Jewish culture. So he's taking the expansive view over there that kukus hagayim does not have to be limited to idol worship. It means anything which is from a foreign culture, an alien culture, and is not natively Jewish. And again, de facto, tacitly, that seems to be the assumption of all the poskim, who generally, if they can find the root of any practice in a non-Jewish alien culture, will not usually stop to say, are they really idol worshippers? Is it just an alien culture? Generally, the poskim seem to assume that anything which is inherently non-Jewish is going to be prohibited, regardless of whether they're old-fashioned pagans or Egyptians or Canaanites or not. But the key question, of course, is what types of practices are usher? As the Torah Kahnem says, we build houses like they do. You know, as the expression goes, we put our pants on one leg at a time, just like they do. So what's prohibited and what is permitted? And this is something, as I said, which is a tremendously unsettled area. These halachas are in Shulchan Aruch. This halacha was always understood from the time of the Gemara down to the contemporary poskim as not just a general gauzy exhortation to be good, to not follow bad practices. It was understood as a formal law in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, in the Gemara, in the Shulchan Aruch. But the Shulchan Aruch doesn't give us that much guidance for what exactly is usher and what exactly is mutter. The Chazal in various places, Tosefta, Gemara and Shabbos, other places, the Gemara does give us throughout Shas lists various examples of practices which are usher. They basically refer to different types of dreadfully superstitious or pagan practices, ceremonies and rituals, the deeply superstitious things that have no rational meaning, or clearly some kind of pre-modern pagan or superstitious practice. But again, the Gemara doesn't give us much in the way of general guidance for what is usher, what is mutter. The Rishonim offer all kinds of formulations, partly to just kind of rationalize the prohibition, partly to reconcile contradictory sugyas. But again, which of the sheetahs in the Rishonim is accepted is far from clear. The Rishonim are kind of all over the map on this, and the Achronim, too, are all over the map. So for the remainder of our talk, I want to discuss this from the perspective of case studies, discuss actual halachas, actual customs and halachas that were debated by the poskim. I say debated, virtually everything we're going to discuss is a subject of debate. There is very, very little in this area that is settled as being asur. For almost anything, almost any question that arose, there were some who asur and some who were matir. And again, part of the reason, we're not going to go through systematically all the Rishonim and all the Gemaras, partly because it's just very complicated, partly it would have taken, I have to admit, many more hours of preparation than I managed to find time for. But I think it will be illuminating, informative to consider the topic through cases, actual debates the poskim had about things which are asur and things which are mutar. So I'm also going to digress a little bit into some of the biographies of some of the poskim discussing this, partly because they're interesting, partly because this is the sort of topic, as we'll see, as poskim sometimes articulate, beyond the formal discussion of what's asur, what's mutar, what's considered chukas legayim and what's not. There is a general sense of poskim occasionally were trying to asur things they felt were just bad for the health of Klal Yisrael, they felt were inroads of the reform movement, and they felt were systematic attacks on Judaism. So very often we'll find that the context and the overall context and framework in which the poskim was operating, the poskim themselves acknowledges sometimes. Rav Avadia Yosef, for example, he has several masterful discussions on the topic. Get to them a little bit later. He discusses various funereal practices, hearses, black armbands, flowers on coffins, as well as non-Jewish names, non-Jewish dates. Rav Avadia himself is very lenient. Mikra Din, he allows most of the stuff. At one point, we were discussing, I think, the hearses and black horses and hearse special hearses reserved for carrying mason to burial. So he himself is lenient, and when he discusses some of the opinions of the Machmirim, some of the Hungarians 100 years ago, he says it's clear that the reason they were so upset, probably it wasn't because, you know, on balance and a purely neutral halachic analysis, they felt it had to be usher, because they understood that these were inroads by the Reform to, you know, import Christian culture, Western culture, into Judaism to kind of modernize and upgrade and replace Judaism by modern European culture. That's why they were so upset. In the context of that discussion of hearses, he quotes a certain Rav, he says, who basically laid down the gauntlet on this question. The community wanted to use hearses, and he said, absolutely not. He resigned from the rabbinate because of this, accepted a position somewhere else. When he got to the new city, he saw that it was an old Jewish custom to do this too, that the Jews had been doing this for centuries. He said, all right, I guess it's not so bad after all, so he kept the second position. But in general, you know, this is not just me. In my analysis, there were people like Rav Avadia and others have acknowledged that some of the fury and some of the passion clearly had to do with the fact that this was a kind of symbolic, a battle against the Reform, battle against those who were trying to destroy or dilute Judaism, and that have to be taken into account. For example, we're about to discuss some tshuvas about bells and clocks and synagogues. So Rav Avadia, when he discusses some of this literature, he cites a Shaul Meshiv, Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson. Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson says, his shaila has nothing to do with chukas hagoyim. His shaila was, he says, there was once a Jew who donated a clock to the synagogue. So he thought he was doing a nice thing. Shuls, you know, clocks are good. He says it created a tremendous controversy with some of the hardliners and reactionaries. Threw the clock out of the shul. They refused to allow it into the shul. Now the guy wanted to know a Hilchos Tzedakah question. I made a neder. I donated the clock to the shul. I didn't want it. So can I take it back? Do I have to matir neder? What should I do? So the Shaul Meshiv does not discuss whether clocks belong in shuls or not. He just acknowledges the reality that the clock was an enormously controversial innovation, and basically says it can be matir neder. You don't even have to be matir neder, because clearly he wanted to do a nice thing, lefayer beis Hashem, to glorify the house of God, and chalila, he didn't want to start fights and machlokas, so clearly, you know, al das kein, he never would have done it. So yes, he can be matir neder with a good conscience and take it home. The clock was a tremendously controversial innovation in 19th century Europe. I didn't have a chance to look it up, but years ago I seem to recall once reading in the Sefer Tamei HaMenhagim, where he talks about the whole Hungarian attitude of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, the Yabi Yomer brings, anything new is pasul, is treif, is a suspect of reform. They talk about how once again, Tamei HaMenhagim says, once someone brought a clock into shul, and the good, God-fearing Jews were outraged. They solemnly marched up to the clock, they took it down, they smashed it, and they hurled it out, and they said, no modern reform innovation shall ever enter our shul. But anyway, one of the most remarkable, fascinating tshuvas on the subject of Chukas HaGoyim is a tshuva in the Sefer Krach Shel Romi. Sefer Krak Shel Romi, literally City of Rome, Talmudic phrase, was written by Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan. He was a scion of the legendary Chazan family, arguably the first family of Sephardic rabbinics. They had centuries of Rabbanim, literally like a dozen generations, one after another, of leading Rabbanim. The most famous, probably the most glorious of them all, was Rabbi Rafael Yosef Chazan, Yosef Rafael Chazan, 200 years ago. He was the author of the Chikrei Lev, a monumental, several thousand page work on all of Halacha, all of Torah. He was called Hayareach sometimes, Yudresh for Yudresh Chess, Yosef Rafael Chazan. He had ancestors and sons and grandsons who were all, he was actually a grandfather of Chaim Palagi too. Anyway, the Krak Shel Romi was one of his, I think, grandsons or so, about 100 years later, he's actually in various cities in Europe, including Rome, where he was a rabbi in Rome for a while. Very interesting fellow. The very first tshuva was about erecting a clock and a bell in the synagogue to call people to tshuva. A very, very long tshuva. It's a tour de force on the subject of Kukas HaGoyim. Just read the way he describes the case. It makes for, again, instructive and interesting reading. He says, Maisa Po in the air Rome, the city of Rome. He says, people on Shabbos and Yontif were coming late to shul. Sometimes it happens, people came late to shul. So what did I do? He says, my first reaction was, Nizdazarti, Nizdarazti, B'chol Kochi. So I roused myself with Sadr Lehem, Shos Drabanan. I made a calendar, I made a sheet, an announcement sheet, so they should know what time davening was, Al Pi HaShulchan Aruch. So they should know what time to come. And we put it up in Italian, B'chseb B'loshim, B'chseb Italki. We had signs telling everyone what time davening was. Somehow that didn't work. Even having posted signs still didn't get everyone to come to shul on time. They were late, people just weren't getting there on time. They had excuses, they said they weren't sure what time it was, not everyone had smartphones and watches and whatnot. So I had a new idea, he says. Gazarti Omer, this is his own idea apparently, L'chadesh Kliya Shos Hanikra Horologio. I wanted to have a Kliya Shos, we would call a clock, called basically a Horologio, which is some kind of Italian or European word, Lashon Horo, hours or time. So I wanted to have some kind of time-telling device. I wanted to erect it in the shul courtyard or outside, and then it would be prominent and public, and it would make sure everyone knew the time. Nobody would have any excuse for not coming to shul on time. So this aroused controversy. People said maybe it's not a good idea. Why not? So he said that the clock was the first step. They also wanted to have a zug hamikash keshashos. They wanted to have a bell that would ring out the hours. So some people said maybe we shouldn't do that. Because why? Because in the batei kneisios hanotzrim, because in the synagogues of the Christians, the churches, that's what they have. They have bell towers and clocks and announcing the times. So it's not really worship, it's just a practical measure to announce times, but he says, maybe that's Kukas HaGoyim. That was the shaila. Can we build a bell tower in the shul courtyard for the purpose of making sure people come on time to daven? So he has, again, this masterful tshuva, 8-10 pages, where he goes through the sugya of Kukas HaGoyim. And he's basically lenient, for reasons we'll discuss soon. His basic position is, which I think is probably the dominant position among the poskim, that, again, going back to that Taras Kahanim, that anything which is a normal, sensible, rational custom, we don't prohibit. We'll discuss exactly the basis plan of the poskim soon. That's basically his approach. He argues at length for this basic idea, that anything which is a rational, sensible, non-pagan, non-superstitious, non-vulgar, decent custom is fine, even if we are adopting a practice which the non-Jews have. That's his position. In the context of his tshuva, he has a very, very famous, somewhat controversial passage, much discussed today. One of the most hotly debated topics for the last couple hundred years, in this area is borrowing music of the non-Jews. Sacred music, church music, borrowing folk music, borrowing peasant songs, love songs, marching songs, military songs, even church music, and using them just for entertainment or even using them for davening. So the Hasidim famously often did this. The Hasidim often used European songs, whether they were marching songs. The Hasidus of Ger is famous for their kind of Polish songs, marching, stirring, martial type of music. Some of the other Hasidim, some of the Hungarians, actually borrowed love songs. There's a famous, Szalak Kakashmer maybe, I'm not sure, but there are some famous Hungarian Hasidic songs. One of them is famously was an old shepherd's love song to his beloved. The original song was about a rose. and his rose is so sweet and so far away, and the Hasidim adopted that to the soul of the Jew yearning for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So then this was done. There's no question that non-Jewish music was borrowed and adapted and adopted by Jews. So different justifications why. If you know, within the Hasidic Kabbalistic tradition, you'll find talk of Nitzotzos, about rescuing the Kedusha that is present in the non-Jews. Whatever it is, historically we know that the music was borrowed. The Krach Shel Romi has one of the most eyebrow-raising defenses of this practice. He says, "Made on Eli Shemayim Varetz, I swear to you," he says, "when I was in the great city, Er Gedola Shel Chachamim Shel Sofer." If you ask a Lithuanian yeshiva student what's an Er Gedola Shel Chachamim Shel Sofer, he'll tell you Brisk, he'll tell you Vilna maybe. For the Sfardim, the city was Smyrna, Izmir. And if you study the Sfardic literature, going back to the 500 years, the time of the Beis Yosef, Smyrna, Izmir, Constantinople, the great Sfardic cities of full of Chachamim, full of Shivas, full of Rabbanim. When I was in Smyrna, he says, and Yer Ve'em B'Yisrael, so he says, there were great Chachamim, who were also Chazanim, who were Mishorim Gedolim Al Mishkal HaMuzika. They were expert musicians, expert singers. He gives some names. And he says, for the Yom Narayim, when they wanted to design their plan, their Yom Narayim davening, so what would they do? Yom Narayim davening, he says, the mood we want to evoke is Hachna Gedola Hanikra Etzlam Chizun. Not sure what chizun is, but they wanted to arouse a mood of hachna, of submission, of religious devotion. So what would they do? They would go to the churches. They would be like behind a little mechitza, behind a partition. On the Christian holidays, to study from them. Osam kol hamuchna v'mashaber halev, because the music they were using was beautifully designed to arouse these emotions of devotion, of submission, of religious kind of abnegation. And they would use this music. They would integrate this music into kaddish and kedusha, and it would be a wonderful thing. And he says, Maisa Rav Kazeh. This is a Maisa Rav, the great Chachamim, the great Chazanim in Smyrna, who did this in a city full of Tamid Chachamim, is a Siyu Agadol to my doctrine, he says, to my Shita, which is anything which is not based on superstition and idolatry, that this is mutter, this is fine, this is not a problem. So the Tzitz Eliezer, the Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who was Eretz Yisrael in our time, 50 years ago, so he was absolutely appalled. He was, words cannot describe how furious he was at this tshuva of the Krach Shel Romi. Tzitz Eliezer writes, "Mamish nishtomamti alamara. I'm stunned. I'm just appalled at this tshuva." He says, "Libi lohem, and I can't believe," he says, "what I'm reading." He says, "I'm just nizdazati lishma advarim ka'elu, to hear such appalling things." He says, "How can you possibly say that these melodies of the Christians," he says, "and their worship are nigunim muchnaim eviim avas akel, their music brings the love of God," he says, "v'yichudo." Everyone says that the post can say that Christianity is idol worship and it's not monotheistic and it's terrible. I never felt that they were really talking to each other. The Krach Shel Romi is not arguing theology with the Christians, whether their religion is theologically sound or not. He's arguing emotionally, musically. He's arguing the emotion of worship, of devotion to God, is the same emotion whether you're worshiping, you know, we believe is the true God, what the Christians believe. It's the same religious sense of devotion, like the King of the Khazars, you know, was famously told by the Malach in his vision. He was told, he was a real dyed-in-the-wool pagan when the story starts, and he was told, he was greatly devoted to his idol worship. You mean well, you're trying to worship God, you just have the wrong God. So we have to correct your theology. So, yes, and there are differences between our theology and theirs, aside from abstract theology. There are differences in what they're in, the values of the religion and all that, but in terms of the music and what the music and what emotional resonance the music has, the fact that they might technically be considered polytheistic doesn't mean that the music doesn't have its milos. He goes on and on. He says, Shomu Shamayim, he says such terrible things. He just cannot possibly understand how anyone could say such a thing. And he utterly rejects this position. But again, in discussions of music, of borrowing from the non-Jews, you will see references to this Krach Shel Romi a lot. He was a distinguished Rav, albeit one with some interesting ideas. He felt this was fine. Now, as I said, his basic doctrine is that anything which is not inherently pagan or superstitious is fine. And this, as I said, is the basic shita adopted by many poskim, including Rav Avadia I mentioned earlier. The basic shita is based on a number of Rishonim, most prominently the Maharik, one of the late Italian Rishonim, as well as the Rivash and Aran, other Rishonim. Their basic idea is kind of like in line with one implication of the Taras Kanim and in line with some of the sources in the Gemara. What they basically argue is that the only practices which are usur, they're slightly different formulations and different examples, but what they basically argue is that the only practices which are usur are either those which have no rational basis at all, which are just bizarre rituals or are clearly superstitious or pagan in origin. Like the Gemara gives examples of if a tree was shedding its fruits, they would do some kind of strange ritual. They would tie threads to it. The Gemara actually says that was mutter because the idea was that they would try. The Gemara gives a kind of scientific explanation for what they would do, so it's mutter. But without that, the implication is it would be asur. It would be called darfei hamari. And the way the Rishonim understands something which is clearly a superstitious, supernatural, non-rational custom, that's asur because we suspect it of idolatrous or pagan origins. Furthermore, any type of practice which is inherently indecent, which is pritzus, which shows a lack of humility, which fashions, for example, which are either considered indecent, they're either too showy, or for women, which are too immodest, practices which are inherently bad, and the non-Jews do them, we have no right to adopt them, even if they're not idolatrous, because they're bad from another perspective. So either hevel b'shtus, either if they make no sense, in which case we have to suspect them of idolatry, or if they're inherently things we don't like, those things are awesome. But anything which has a rational basis, which has a logical reason, so they do it, so we do it too. This shita is basically adopted by the Rama. That's why many poskim say this is l'halacha. The case of the Marik, I believe, was actually a case where doctors wore special uniforms, special garb. They had a special hat they wore to show, or a special cape they wore to show that they were physicians. So the question, and again, there was no strictly rational basis. It wasn't like they wore a utility belt to hold all their tools. They wore some kind of signature garment to identify their profession. But the Marik basically said, that's not pagan, that's not superstitious, that's just a cultural convention to show their profession, so that's fine. So the Rama passes this way. The Rama says, "Kol ze eino asur el v'darvish nagubo ha'ov dekachavim the idolaters leither l'shem pritzus, like bright red clothing," he says, which was showy or immodest. Or he says, "Darvish nagulam minigul l'chog vein tam b'darver," something which is mystifying and irrational. What those things? Ikalam echash mishum darchei amari. Those things are pagan idolatrous practices. Sheyesh bo shemet v'aris kachavim avasem avol darvish nagul to anyone who's an expert physician, a distinctive garment, anything they do for respect or for dignity or for another reason is mutter. That's fine. He brings a riot from a Gemara. Not going to get into it right now. And that is the position of the Marik. And that is what the Krakshal Romi feels is lahalacha. That's what Rav Avadia feels is lahalacha. So that's why, for example, Rav Avadia discusses and mentioned earlier the various funereal practices. Using a hearse instead of carrying it. The traditional Jewish practice was to carry on the shoulders. So they still do it today, and very often. I mean, when we drive to the cemetery, you use a car typically, but I mean, yeah, today we don't really have any room for the horse. It's either maybe some military ceremonies or heads of state, maybe they use, I don't know if they still use horses at all, but basically the traditional Jewish method was
royal family in England, prime ministers.
Right, so there you go. That's obviously a covenant of some sorts, and so in 19th century Europe, they had very evolved, very elaborate ceremonial practices, wearing black horses, having a dedicated hearse instead of just a regular wagon. Rav Avadia talks about black armbands, he talks about black ribbons and hats or whatever, he talks about putting flowers on the mace. So he's basically matir all of this mikra din. He argues, some of these things he says actually have roots in Jewish tradition, which is also a big heter many poskim say. If we can find a Jewish source, not that simple, there are complicating factors, but in general, one of the Gemara seems to indicate that if things that are written in the Torah, the Gemara says, la minayu gamrina, and if we can find an authentic Jewish source, we're not really learning from them. Which, again, there are many different approaches to what that means, but at least some learn that means that it's obviously not a pagan custom because we have a Jewish source for it. So that's mutter. So Rav Avadia argues that wearing black has basis, maybe not in Tanakh, but it has basis in the Jewish tradition. So black itself is not so bad. And anyway, he says all these things which are derech kavod, and just, even though they're culturally dependent, not different cultures do different things, that doesn't matter. As we discussed previously once, we discussed things like taking off shoes and taking off hats and putting on shoes and putting on hats. We discussed how many poskim acknowledge that these are cultural conventions. Even if different cultures do things different ways, that doesn't mean it's pagan, it doesn't mean it's superstitious, that means that cultures develop different ways of showing respect. That's all mutter, that's not considered pagan, that's not an abomination, and that's fine. And that's why Rav Avadia basically allows all these things. Now, at the end of the Tshuvas, Rav Avadia does say that in Eretz Yisrael, where we have a Jewish nation and we have a kind of our own culture, there's really no need to look to Western cultures for their practices. We really should, he says, if possible, the mourner should be encouraged to revert to the traditional Jewish customs. But it's not Mikra Din, he says. If they're overwrought and they're not in a frame of mind to listen, and they really want their European or other traditional practices, la halacha, it's not usher, even though it's not maybe not ideal, he says, but la halacha, it's not prohibited. La halacha, it's mutter, based on this doctrine of Marik, which he says is normative.
They use the armbands to replace Korea?
To replace Korea? Interesting question. I don't know. If they were doing it instead of Korea, then you would have the thing I mentioned before. If it was seen.
They wear things on their jackets. I saw that when I was a kid.
They didn't tear Korea. As I mentioned, Rav Avadia himself, when he discusses some of the opposition to some of these practices, he says, that some of the opposition was talking to people who were doing it to change halacha and to all. So you're right. So in cases where it was meant to kind of abrogate halacha, it would be more serious. Yes, but in the abstract, the mere fact that you want to add an additional custom and you're not contradicting or revising the actual Jewish customs, at least in those cases, you're right. Everything depends on the cultural context, but at least in general, there is basis for heter. That's the opinion of many, many. This is probably the mainstream sheet in the poskim, but anything which is not overtly pagan or just utterly mysterious to... and again, you find the strangest things in Judaism. I think it was Beryl Wine, or Beryl Wine has a famous line about Judaism is always very, very reluctant to throw out the baby. The bathwater is the very reluctant to jettison any custom, he says. The downside is that Judaism collects a lot of bathwater over the ages. I once saw some svarim they bring, that there was a custom among some European Jews, when they went to a cemetery, they would bring garlic with them. So anyone who's read Dracula or Western occult stories in general knows that Dracula, garlic, keeping away the undead, keeping away demons, is a traditional Eastern European folk belief. Yet the Nitzan Gavriel brings Jewish sources for this and argues he finds an interesting basis for it in Jewish ideas. You can find a basis for almost anything, yet you know there's almost nothing I can think of that isn't clearly a superstition borrowed from local pagans, as garlic and vampires. In any event, you know, it can be very difficult sometimes to untangle it. We just had Shabbos of the Schlissel Challahs, where there are some contemporary writers who argue that Schlissel Challahs have some Christological basis in Easter and hot cross buns. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's hard to imagine that this is an ancient Jewish custom that goes back maybe 200 or 300 years. In any event, the mainstream approach is certainly something which is not superstitious sounding and more or less rational. The poskim will typically allow. Going back to bell ringing for a minute, churches, synagogues, towers, and clocks, we do find some achronim who were vehemently opposed to bells and clocks and shuls, particularly bells. One of them is Ritzvi Hirsch Chayes, the Maritz Chayes. Maritz Chayes is one of those unfortunate, unlucky people who kind of got hammered from both ends. There's a famous PhD thesis by Rebbetzin Beruya David, Rav Huttner's daughter and the wife of Yonason David of Pachad Yitzchak. She wrote her doctoral thesis in Columbia on Ritzvi Hirsch Chayes, masculine or traditionalist. Was he a masculine? Was he one of the reformers, so to speak, of the 19th century, or was he a traditionalist? And this was a subject that, because she's not the first one to raise it, this was debated hotly in his time. We find vehement attacks on the man and his work by some achronim who felt he was giving too much quarter to the reformers. He was an educated person. He did have a great interest in modern scholarship and modern study of the Talmud. On the other hand, he was a vehement anti-reformer. He battled vigorously against the reform. He was attacked by both sides for this, and you know he is printed in the back of the Gemara. The the Shaul Meshev has had a vehement tshuva attacking him, where he writes that he sharply criticizes his commentary, and Chassam Sofer actually writes very politely to him, writes with a great deal of respect to him. One of the Chassam Sofer's really, really hardline followers, Rav Schlesinger, writes that Chassam Sofer was only polite to him. He wanted to make sure he didn't go totally off the deep end and join. He didn't really deserve such gracious language. He wanted to make sure he didn't totally get on board with the reformers. Others have argued just the opposite, that the Shaul Meshev, when he used such vehement language on him, he wanted to make sure that he wouldn't be seen as a role model by the young yeshiva students. He really thought he was a decent fellow, but he wanted to make sure that he wasn't set up as a new role model, Toru Mada, for the young Galitzin yeshiva students. In any event, Maritz Chayes was a complicated person.
They didn't know what to do with him.
Yes, exactly. But today I think the verdict is he's considered a serious god. There's no question, though, he was a vehement opponent of the reform, and he opposed many of their innovations. And in one passage in a work of his called Minchas Kenos, which, like it sounds, was a zealous attack on the reform, he writes, he's sharply criticizing various reformist practices. He writes, some people build synagogues octagons, he calls binyan b'shmona tzlos, kolshkein b'arba tzlos, certainly a building of four sides, but which I don't think he means a square, I think he means more like a cross. He says, kidmus hechle agayim, like the churches. He says, aleim anikare v'yishkach Yisrael oseihu v'yivan hechalos. The Navi says, the Jews have forgotten their creator and build temples.
What's wrong with the octagon?
What?
What's the problem with the octagon?
I'm not sure exactly what shape.
I think it's like the Eastern, like the Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox churches.
Yes, I was assuming he meant cruciform church architecture. They had nave and I forget the words for it. There's a whole, you can find whole Wikipedia articles on it. How the certain churches were typically arranged, basically in chassis ve'erev and cruciform form, the altar in the middle, the something in front, the septs on the side, and it was a fairly standard, going back thousands of years. It was a fairly standard form of church plan to symbolize a cross or for other reasons. So he was very, very opposed to it. He argues it's chukas hagayim, and he goes on and he says, those who use bells to gather people to tefillah. He says he read in one of the journals, Baalei HaYehudim, he says, in some small places in Germany they do this. Over in Bazeh, Balav Shel Torah, they're violating a biblical prohibition. He says, we Jews typically use other methods. We had either a shofar, Pashas Baloska, he says, or we had, he says, in Arches HaMizrach, in the eastern lands, the Sephardic countries, he says, sometimes they use knocking on doors. He says, we in Europe, we use knocking on doors. He read that in the eastern countries, they still use the shofar, he says, or if you don't want to use the shofar, you look for another technique, he says, do something else. You don't have to stick to the traditional method of door knockers or of shofar, he says, but to use a bell, he says, bell is absolutely awesome, because the same look telech when it's a lav daraisa. We find the same thing in the Sefer Shvilei David, also around the same time, he says, not that long ago, he says, the custom used to be the shamash would go and knock on doors. He says, why don't they use a bell? A bell is a very easy bit of technology to implement. Why do they have to go tediously knocking on doors? Because that would be considered a non-Jewish practice. We must not adopt bell ringing because that is usher. He says, isser gam. So again, the Krach Shel Romi felt this was fine. It's a perfectly rational thing. No reason to usher it. These other achronim, including the Maritz Chayes himself, who was occasionally took a very hard line against non-Jewish practices, they felt it was usher. The Krach Shel Romi said it was mutter.
I would think, what if you get opposition to bell ring, to people bell ringing from the Gentiles, right? You're ringing bell at the time, at the time of Alos HaShachar, which is like 12 and a half minutes before 6 a.m. when their church bells are going off. It messes things up.
I guess you can argue, right, when he tries to say, why didn't they do it? The answer could have been because they wouldn't have tolerated it. We were guests in a hostile culture very often. We probably couldn't have gotten it. Sometimes they had, I guess, their own ghettos, their own quarter. Yeah, you're right. You can definitely argue that they couldn't build the shuls, the highest building, very often because they wouldn't have been tolerated. So, yeah, you certainly argue that bells weren't, for realistic reasons, weren't an option. I don't think he's talking about handheld bell. I think he's talking about. I think he's talking about more like church bells. I'm not sure, but I assume he's talking more like church bells.
Whistles,
right? There, this custom of the shamash knocking on the door is actually a minor digression. This goes back a long way. This goes back. There's a very, very charming passage in the Meiri. We say Slicha, it's Ashkenazim, for a week or so before Rosh Hashanah, the Sfaradim for a month before Rosh Hashanah. The Meiri, I think, had the Sfaradim custom a month before Rosh Hashanah. So he brings, he records that in his time there was a dispute about whether Slichas was said on Shabbos. We, I think, don't, at least Ashkenazim don't. I don't know what Sfaradim do, but we say Slich, we do not say Slichas on Shabbos morning. Some communities did. So the Meiri records that there were two schools of thought. Some approved of it and some did not. So those who did not made three arguments. First of all, they said the tone and the mood of Slichas is very somber, is very, very serious. It's a contradiction to the joy and the happiness of Shabbos. B, he says, you have to get up early. On Shabbos, we get up a little bit later, and we don't get up so early on Shabbos. But in general, we get up later. We don't want to get up so early on Shabbos. And C, they said, you wake people up, they said, by, for Slichas. I don't know about every Shabbos morning, but at least for Slichas, they used to wake up by knocking on the doors and having these, they would use wooden door knockers. And on Shabbos, that's usher, that's a form of Hashmas Kol, that's a form of Avsha Milsa, and we don't use door knockers on Shabbos. So Miri says, each of these three arguments has an answer by the pro-Slichas camp. Regarding the question of the mood, he says, you're right, so you use different slichas. You don't use the same slichas, which are all, you know, worry and concern. You use more uplifting slichas about the greatness of Hashem and His mercy, and the mood is taka different. He says, regarding getting up early, I think he says that it's good. We're getting up early for a good reason, to do tshuva and to bring yourself close to Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's fine, it's not a problem. And regarding door knockers, he says, all right, don't use the wooden door knockers. Just knock with your hands or call out through the window. You can do it one day a week without using the dedicated door knockers. So I'll just mention one other example. I don't know how much more time we have. One other example of the Chutz Hagayim we mentioned earlier was the organ. The organ was a ferocious battle in the 19th century, one of the great kind of symbolic fights of the Reform against the traditional. The Reform movement wanted to introduce the organ music into shuls, which obviously was like the churches had. And the Orthodox establishment pretty much unanimously fought it vehemently. And pretty much won. The Orthodox shuls, you never accepted the organ in. It's worth noting that Rav David Zvi Hoffman himself, who was a vehement opponent, Rav David Zvi Hoffman was a cultured, very modern posek. He was a university educated, he held a doctorate, he was one of the most westernized and acculturated rabbanim of anyone at that time, but he was staunchly Orthodox, and he was also a vehement, if not always, he was polite, and he was, he never got to the same level of polemic, but he was an implacable opponent of Reform. He fought bitterly against the organ also, quoted all the precedent against it. He acknowledges in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, in Prague there was one shul that had an organ for about 300 years, going back several centuries. There was one shul that we have traditions that did have an organ. They did not play the organ on Shabbos. They had a special takana that they played it during Kabbalah Shabbos, but Kabbalah Shabbos would be stopped, I think, a half hour of official rules. Organ must be shut off a half hour before Shabbos to avoid, I guess, getting too close to Shabbos. So they say, the Rav David Zvi Hoffman says, even if I'm opposed to organs, that's because today it's a symbol of Christianity. Today it was a battle of the Reform. He says, back then, it was before the organ became a symbol of Christian worship. They started earlier, and today they don't have it anymore, he said. But in general, Rav David Zvi Hoffman was vehemently opposed to the organ, as were many of his predecessors. And one of the main arguments they made was, aside from the question of playing on Shabbos, one of the main arguments they made was that it was Chukas HaGoyim. So again, even though, as we've seen, the Krak Shel Romi, for example, argues that anything which is sensible and has a rational basis, just kind of neutral religious devotion, is okay, Rav David Zvi Hoffman argues that the organ, they don't just play violin and trombone in churches, at least back then. They used to play specifically the organ. An organ was pretty much reserved for sacred music. Organs weren't played at other concerts and outside. He says the organ has become so bound up with religious worship, it's a symbol of religious worship. So I don't know what he would have said about the Krak Shel Romi, but he does emphasize that in his case, the organ was peculiarly, inherently a Christian thing, and therefore it would be wrong to use it in shuls. And he brings, as I said, numerous other achronim who argued that the organ was absolutely forbidden on the grounds of it being Chukas HaGoyim. One of the issues that Chukas HaGoyim comes up most commonly is in dress and style. Here we find poskim all over the map. We do find poskim in some cultures in Europe where the Jews used to dress distinctively, who argued that if a Jew adopts Western dress, if he drops the old traditional Jewish dress and adopts Western dress, that's Chukas HaGoyim. Obviously, our practice here in the United States is that we do wear Western dress, except in some of the Hasidim, we certainly do wear Western dress. And again, there are people who allow that too, who argue that even though fashion is pretty mystifying, even though what they decree in Paris each year, the question of why lapels get wider, why lapels get thinner, why ties get thinner, and hat brims get wider, even though this is deeply mystifying and arguably doesn't pass any sort of rational basis test. I remember once arguing with some of my siblings who were looking at my parents' wedding albums, and we were kind of laughing at what the fashions were, the Coke bottle glasses and the tiny little hats. And I was, of course, saying that, well, of course, our kids will be looking at us and laughing at our fashions the same way. My sister was like, no, our fashions are timeless, and theirs were just weird. Ours are, okay. So obviously fashion is pretty mystifying, and it's hard to find a rational basis for most of it. But nevertheless, I think the consensus of the poskim is it's not pagan, it's not superstitious, it's just, quirky style. Style changes. So the poskim generally, I think, the mainstream poskim do not, in a culture certainly that's already used to wearing Western dress, for sure, poskim do not forbid wearing Western dress. There are certain specific questions of clothing which have been hotly debated, questions of Chukas HaGoyim. So one question, for example, is kisi rosh, covering heads. Ashkenazim have traditionally been more strict about it than Sfaradim. One of the reasons that some of the Ashkenazic poskim, the Gemara itself is not always clear whether you have to wear a yarmulke all the time, some of the time when you daven, Ashkenazim typically do, Sfaradim less so, not because it's more Sfaradim are more lax, because Sfaradim have a different halakhic tradition where the Sfaradic Rishonim were less, much less insistent about it. One of the reasons the Ashkenazim were so strict about it is because they felt in Christian cultures that taking off a hat was a sign of religious devotion. The Taz famously said that wearing a yarmulke, keeping your head covered, is necessary to avoid Chukas HaGoyim. Other Rakhonim said no. Yosef Masas, the great Moroccan authority, said no. It's cultural. It's a cultural sign of respect. Whatever your culture does, your culture put on a hat to show respect. You put on a hat to show respect. Jack Kennedy took off his hat. Now we don't wear hats. Not covering your head can be respectful. There's no, it's not a religious thing. Everything is Lufi HaInyan, it's cultural, and in general, there are some Ashkenazic posts who said uncovering your head is Chukas HaGoyim, but I don't know if that is the dominant or certainly not the universal view.